Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs.
Hi, this is Tina with the Your Family Dog podcast, and today I'm joined by my smart and pretty co-host, Julie Fudge-Smith, who today gets to just roll around in her entomology, which makes her happy. I do want to say in the intro, and I didn't warn Julie I was doing this, that I've been listening to her book, The Beast Keeper, while I'm sewing on audiobook, and it is phenomenal. It makes me smile. It makes me laugh. It makes me see the good in the world. So I cannot recommend it enough. And I hope that you will share it, whether in a printed form or in the audiobook form, with someone you know and love. It'll make you laugh. It's just a great read. And I cannot recommend it enough. So this week on the Your Family Dog podcast, we're going to talk about cicadas, because much of the country is about to have a cicada experience that might be pretty impressive. The states that are going to be impacted here in the United States are Alaska does not actually have cicadas, to the best of my knowledge. If they start getting cicadas.
Well, we could sing the state song if you wanted to.
We
Alabama,
could.
Okay.
So
Arkansas.
Let me start that over. So Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Wisconsin, and Virginia. That's a pretty substantive list from my perspective. And maybe I think that just because I'm in the middle of it. So this week, we're going to talk about the cicada broods that are going to be emerging in May. This will continue through the end of June. Some of that's dependent on weather and how that integrates with your family dog, because anyone who has lived through cicadas with dogs has a story. So now that I've done the introduction, I will turn you over to the Your Family Dog entomologist, Julie Fudge-Smith, and she can expound on the cicada.
Well, thank you, Dean. Thank you for that lovely endorsement of my book. My narrator was a great deal of fun to work with. Benjamin Fife, he does a great job with animating the characters. And I'm so glad that you're enjoying it. So thank you. And I will just add on to that I am a finalist in the Wishing Shelf Awards, which is a literary group in both London and Stockholm. And we'll find out in April, maybe by the time this is published, who knows? I may or may not be a winner of the Wishing Shelf Awards.
Which
anyway,
would be fantastic.
It would be fantastic.
This book is fantastic. It is.
Thank you.
It is so enjoyable without being fluff, which I'm finding a really beautiful mix, right? Like, it's not written like a cartoon. It's not. But it is lighthearted enough to cleanse the palate for much of life these days. So if you need a great palate cleanser, get it. It's phenomenal.
Thank you, Tina. I truly appreciate that. And the intention was that you could either read it as a fairly light novel. This is not Tolstoy. But it does have a little oomph to it, as one of the questions I ask is, what is the quality of mercy we owe our enemies? So think about that as you're reading through the book. So, okay, but on to cicadas. My other great love in life, well, one of my great loves in life is entomology. I know that sounds very odd, but I had a wonderful entomology teacher in college. And although I was just a biology major, I did a lot of stuff with bugs. And as anybody who knows me well will tell you, that bugs are insects. And that if you call a spider a bug around me, or a millipede or a centipede a bug, I will correct you. That's just the bottom line.
Mr. Taunton and I had a big conversation just this week about are scorpions arachnids? So we were Googling at, I don't know, 11:30 at night. We were Googling the family that scorpions are in.
Well, they are related. They're related to spiders and mites, yeah, and insects, and that they're all in, they're all crustaceans. Anyway, specifically, true bugs are the hemipterans. The cicada is a hemopteran, okay, which is another type of bug, which means that it has the classic head, thorax, abdomen, six legs, and two pairs of wings. The interesting thing about cicadas, as opposed to other hemopterans, is that they make a lot of noise. Most hemopterans are pretty silent bugs.
They are not silent.
They
will rap. We are in for it. So the year that I moved to Georgia, we drove through cicadas that then erupted in Athens. So I asked Julie earlier, like, can we look up which brood that was? Because that's the only one I've ever experienced. And I was so glad we didn't have any in 2021. They are a hot mess and gross and awful in a whole host of ways, not the least of which it breaks my heart every time I walk or drive, because you can literally hear that you're squishing them. It's awful. I'm too tenderhearted. Driving over cicadas makes me crazy. So I'm going to be quiet now.
Okay. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, there's two types of cicadas. The first one is what they call the dog day cicadas. And those are the ones that come out every year. And the ones that you hear in July and August during the dog days of summer. And they look different than your periodical cicadas. And they tend to be blacker, and they're not the same thing as the periodical cicadas. The periodical cicadas are either 17 or 13 years that their broods come out. And there's different broods. There's at least 13 broods of 17-year cicadas. That's what I found I was so excited when Tina sent me the article, because I got to pull out my board, the long and triple horn study of insects book that I've had since college. So anyway, it might be a little outdated. They may have found that there are more, but there are at least 13 broods of 17-year cicadas and 5 of the 13-year cicadas. Now, they tend to have red eyes. That's how you can tell the difference between them and the dog day cicadas. And the fact that we have them cycling, the 13 and the 17-year cicadas coming out the same year, that's an amazing phenomenon. And it only happens every 221 years. The last time was 1803 and Thomas Jefferson was president. The next time will be in 2245. So it's not very often that we have them cycling out at the same time. What's interesting is that as they come out, they don't have a lot of overlapping territory, which would make perfect sense, because what you don't want is to have a real competition for resources. So the fact that they're both coming out at the same time is interesting. We'll put a link to this article that Tina sent. That there's a little map, and they are coming out perhaps at the same time, but in different regions. So that, for example, in Illinois, it's in northern Illinois that you're going to have brood 8, and more southern Illinois, we will have brood 19. Brood 19, I believe, is the 17-year. Brood 8 is the 13-year cicada. So that's kind of interesting. There are 6 species of periodic cicadas within these broods. There are 3 17-year cicadas species, and there are 3 13-year species. What's interesting is they emerge, and then they go through their final molt into adults, and then they reproduce. And the damage that is done to crops and plants and trees and stuff is the egg-laying stage of the adult, because they lay their eggs into twigs and small branches of trees. And it's when the eggs emerge as larvae that you really had the damage done.
And hitting them with your car. Like, so when you squash them, like on your car, it can destroy your car paint. So it's not just the damage they do to crops. I am only growing rabbit poop apparently in my yard, but so I'm not worried about that at all. But I am worried about our vehicles driving through them. For it's a plague of locusts. Are cicadas locusts technically or no?
No. No,
so this locusts is not a plague of locusts.
It's close, but not no cigar.
Close, but no cigar. Close, but no revelation. Okay.
No, it's locusts are generally considered to be grasshoppers. So, but I, while you talk about something about the cicadas, I'm going to look up locusts in word, the long and triple horn, and get a definitive definition.
Well, already then. Okay. Yeah, so okay. What made me, so again, I had moved from upstate New York to Georgia in 1995, and got to experience locusts or not locusts, cicadas for the very first time. And it was stunning. It was almost as stunning as the love bugs, which I think actually happened at about the same time and were equally as gross. So, it was traumatic. I had a traumatic experience with the cicadas. So they scream. You can hear them in your house with the radio on. Like the volume of sound that these insects create is phenomenal. And some people really, really like it. And it's kind of like the smell of skunk. Like, I don't mind the smell of skunk. I know that's weird. I would not want it on me or my dogs, but I'm one of those weirdos that I don't find it awfully offensive, where other people, it makes their skin crawl. Cicadas are very loud, very.
They are. And I can tell you the three different ways in which they make sound.
Oh, well, being squished under feet or tires.
Yeah, but when they are not being abused by motorized vehicles, they make sound one of three ways. Most of them is by, they have what's called a tympanum or a tympum, which is kind of like their eardrum on their thorax. And they have muscles there that make it vibrate, and that causes a sound.
Wait,
but there are also
muscles?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, they do.
Okay.
How else do you do their little legs?
I don't know. I don't know. They're kind of mechanical.
A large pair of muscles runs through the air sac from above the tympana to the large plate of the temples. And so the muscle causes them to vibrate the air against the tympanum and making this noise. But we also have those that stridulate and wing banging cicadas. So stridulation happens with the abdomen is segmented, right? There's these little overlapping plates. And when the plates rub against each other, that is stridulation.
But wing isn't banging that the normal cicada sound that we all don't mind?
No, that's the tympanum.
Oh,
is,
okay. The stridulating, that's the normal sound?
And then there's the wing banging, which I just love the very thought of wing banging. Anyway, I can't imitate a wing banging sound.
I wonder if a Pegasus does wing banging.
Wing bang,
it's hard to say three times.
Oh, and by the way, locusts, I was right. Locusts are grasshoppers.
Okay, good to know.
So
I find them less offensive than the cicadas. All right, so I do have a serious question, which is copperheads. I had to learn this in Georgia. I learned a lot of things about venomous snakes in Georgia. It's kind of
I learned it in Virginia, yes.
So it is my understanding that copperheads eat cicada larvae who come to the surface at night. And so they're often found around the base of trees because they're looking for cicada larvae. Does this onslaught of cicada eruption mean that those of us who are in the same air, share our lives with venomous copperheads and cicadas are going to have a much higher snake risk this year?
That is a terrific question for which I do not have an answer. But if you want to keep talking, I'll Google it.
Okay, we need a herpetologist. Bet I can find.
Yeah, I have a herpetologist in my hip pocket. I don't know any herpetologists, but let me see what I can find out.
So when I moved to Georgia and all of a sudden we had all these cicadas, it was fascinating to have cicadas, for example, tangled in my Shih Tzu's coat, where I had to try to wrestle a large, angry insect that was screaming, truly screaming, from the coat of my old dog who did not understand what just happened. I also found that some of my dogs found cicadas to be delicious, and that resulted in some digestive unrest, as we call it in the spring Taunton home. And not a little bit of digestive unrest, like not veterinarian worthy, but definitely rug doctor worthy. So I have no rugs now. So I am living in a little bit of trepidation that we potentially could have screaming insects in my house and in my yard, and my dogs are being made crazy and sick from them. So there, I think your dog would have to eat an awful lot of them to actually have a major problem. And the dogs that I had back in 95, of course, are not currently with me in 2024. So this crew, I haven't seen what they do with cicadas. So I'm unaware how much I will have to manage and navigate for a couple of months while we have them here. I had no idea that cicadas went like to Michigan. I had no idea that Kentucky and Indiana and all these other places had them. Because being from upstate New York, we did not have them. And it was one of the nice things about that state. So yes, I'm trying to prepare ahead of time, to deal with it. So, we will probably be having to rake off the carcasses from when they start dying off.
All right. So what I have found is that yes, copperheads do like cicadas, but it says here, do cicadas draw copperheads? That's the question, right? The emerging cicadas will not attract more copperheads than already live in a given area. In other words, if you see copperheads feeding on the cicada nymphs, it means that copperheads have always been there and were not drawn in from distant habitats. So,
I didn't expect to have a great copperhead migration, though that would be awful as well.
Then I would be moving to Alaska, where there are no snakes and there are no cicadas, because snakes just do me in. I just really don't like snakes.
Yeah.
And you know, before we get a whole bunch of people saying, yes, they're valuable to the environment.
Yes, they're valuable. I just don't want them in my yard.
Right. I personally don't want them in my state, but they're here. And as long as they do their thing, like way over there, I'm fine. But don't come into, like, did I tell you about the snake in the box?
Yes, you did. And it was a very funny story.
Yeah, did I tell that on air? I don't remember.
I think you told me off air.
Okay, well, I can tell.
It was funny.
So we moved to this new house and we have this little red barn, and there is a fairly large mouse population. And we were trying to figure out what we're going to do with this cute little barn. Are we going to turn it into Brad's office? What are we going to do with it? So I'm out there looking around. And the woman the people that we bought the house from, I think she used to have like a little antique business, and she left some of this stuff in the shed. Julie's starting to rock because we're getting to the snake part. So there's this cute box and it's open, and sitting in it is a little tin pan and a wooden shoe insert and a couple of other things. And I thought, oh, well, this is a cute box. This would probably be a good thing to, it would be a good box to add atmosphere to Brad's office. Is that indeed what we decide to do with the shed, which has a mouse population? So of course it has a snake population. So I put the box down and I'm looking around, and I pick it up and I put my hand in there and looked around in the box, right? So I thought, well, I'm going to close the box so mice or whatever don't get in. So I take the little tin out that was holding the box open, And I look in and I have my sunglasses on, which is, I'm never wearing my sunglasses in there again. And I see, I'm like, what? Why is that chain moving? And it wasn't a chain, it was a snake. And the snake came out of the box right past me and onto the floor. And of course, I screamed. And Brad, who's in the garage, has two thoughts. The first one is, huh, I wonder if Julie saw a snake. And the second one was, I wonder if she's hurt because I haven't heard anything since the scream.
There wasn't, maybe loud, actually, there wasn't loud crashing as you went through the wall.
Maybe I should go find out, right? So he comes and he stands, and I'm just standing there holding the box, just shaking. And I'm like, that's staying, and then the box, and then it came out. Anyway, what I realized later is that, you know, snakes will bite you, whether they're venomous or not. And as I told him, I said, you know, if I had reached my hand in the box and the snake had latched onto my hand, I would have died. Not from the venomous snake, but from the fact that I had a snake attached to me, that just would have completely and utterly done me in. Utterly.
Try to just think of them as cute legless lizards.
Oh, I'll try. I like lizards. I like lizards a lot.
I assumed you did. Yeah. So they're just like a really long anole that its legs fell off.
No, they're snakes.
I took a snake that isn't mine to the vet because I couldn't take that the snake was sick.
I would do that too, but it would be an extraordinarily traumatic experience for me to do. But
well,
I would
need someone go with me who would handle the snake. I was not handling the snake. Okay, so we're off cicadas. So when you experienced cicadas in Virginia, did your dogs find them delicious? Scary?
Oh, yeah.
Like, one of my dogs didn't want to go outside during cicada season because he was terrified of the screaming insects.
Wow. No, we didn't have fear of insects. We had a couple of dogs and just completely ignored them. Just like, whatever. There's this stuff on the ground. Rebel, who we found on abandoned on the Chancellorsville battlefield in a trench. So we named him Rebel. We called him our Confederate trenching setter. Anyway, Rebel was such a funny dog, but he loved cicadas. He couldn't wait to go for a walk in our lower meadow and crunch, 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 and it never bothered him in the least. And I didn't let him completely and utterly gorge himself, but whenever he could, he'd eat cicadas. Crunch, crunch, crunch.
One of my dogs used to pick him up and hold him in his mouth while they were screaming. It sounds like screaming is coming out of the dog's mouth. It was traumatic. Like, I'm not joking that I'm a little triggered by the fact we're going to have cicadas again. Because I'm like, no, I've successfully avoided them for a really long time. So, yeah. Right.
Well, there are the dog day cicadas, the ones that come out every year.
And, right. I don't mind those. Those are not traumatic.
The thing
traumatic.
I find about the periodical cicadas that always get me a little bit is their red eyes. They have little beady red eyes.
They do.
But, you know, you can pick them up. I pick them up all the time. They don't bother me in the least.
Right. I don't think they bite or anything.
No, they don't. They don't
just
bite.
Scream.
Apparently. The thing you do have to be a little bit careful of, though, are the cicada killer wasps.
Yeah,
that they come out and they're really kind of creepy looking. But you know, I have a real, this is going to sound very odd, but I really have a soft spot for wasps, bees and wasps. And the reason for that is because they're so much fun to identify. I really wish that you all could see David's face.
The look on my face is like, really?
Yes. That was the one when I took my entomology course. We had to make an insect collection, and it was really, they're very interesting to identify.
Well, I'll be boxing some stuff up for you and shipping it to Ohio.
Anyway, so that's why I like bees and wasps. I don't like them because I sting, but about the cicada killer wasp, only the female has stingers, and they're not venomous. But they do, it will hurt. So just be a little bit careful of the cicada killer wasps.
Right.
Those also won't, they're not venomous. They're not, cicadas and wasps are not toxic to your dog. And if your dog eats a female and gets stung in the mouth, just keep an eye on, make sure that the dog is not having a severe reaction to it.
Right.
But hopefully that will be the lesson learned. I don't eat these little guys because it hurts. It's actually a perfect example of a correct punishment. What you have is, I have eaten this wasp. It stung my mouth. It really hurts. I'm not going to do that again. So what you have is, you have a punishment where it's quite proximal to the behavior, right? Behavior is, I eat the wasp. Boom, it hurts. There's a direct association between the pain and the wasp. Hopefully.
You have a Clumber Spaniel. I think during cicada season, you should skip Ireland and bring Clementine down to see how many female wasp stings to the mouth are required for her to learn that lesson.
Okay. Most dogs. I'm not talking about Clementine.
Right. And I'm on the opposite end of the continuum with a terrier.
Yeah.
Who probably in his crate right now is creating a scoreboard for how many female wasp stings he thinks he can get in a summer.
Okay.
He has a DNR. Okay. So I'm kidding. He doesn't have a DNR. I'm kidding. I'm joking. Okay. So according to Hudson Animal Hospital, which when I Googled, because God love the Google, when I Googled cicadas and dogs in an attempt to like prepare myself, of course, it says that they are not toxic, but that they have crunchy exoskeletons. I was aware of that already. They're also slippery, and that, like anything in excess, can cause stomach irritation, vomiting, and diarrhea. So if Mister starts eating them like popcorn, I'm going to have to come up with a way to have something better than crunchy cicada jerky in the backyard to get him to eat that instead. And that I really don't need to...
Is he talking about the crunchy exoskeleton? Of course it's crunchy. It's an exoskeleton. That's a redundancy.
Well, I didn't write the article. So I do love that they're like, here, you can, this is what you can do. You can distract your pet with a game of fetch or giving him a command. We don't give commands. We give cues here at Your Family Dog. But if I tried to play fetch with Marco to get him to leave a cicada alone, he would just look at me like dogs that play fetch are dumb. Okay. Keep your cat.
And what if the ball lands in a bunch of cicadas? How is it? I'm not going to grab a mouthful of cicadas and the ball.
Right, exactly. They're like, oh, have your dog on a leash. If they think that Mr. can't eat cicadas while on a leash, I'm starting to wonder if this veterinary hospital has never owned a terrier.
What is it that a terrier can't do on leash? I think terriers can pretty much do anything on leash that they can do off leash. I've never met a terrier that wasn't that talented.
And then the ASPCA tries to make me feel better by going, it'll be okay. Your dog also has dangers eating caterpillars and Asian lady beetles and walking sticks. And I'm like, I don't want to know more terrifying things. Stop it. I have enough of that. There's no mention of the stink bugs, which... Ugh. Are awful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And everywhere. I had no idea that Asian lady beetles can give dogs ulcers.
I had no idea about that either. I'm like, oh, yay. And luckily, apparently, my dog doesn't seem very interested in ladybugs.
Walking sticks also make for very sick dogs, right? And are potentially emergencies. Same with caterpillars. So I was just, when I saw the cicadas are coming, I was like, oh no. I even looked at the little map and my county appears to be bright red, where I think we're going to get both broods.
No, what the bright red means is that you get a particular brood. The light.
Oh, so I might not have a double dose.
Right, right. If you read the map, because I thought the same thing. So it's just.
I read it quickly and I had a headache.
They coded it differently for each brood. So there's very little overlap on the territories between the broods, which makes perfect sense evolutionarily, if you think about it, because why would you have overlapping territories for, you know, resource? Because you can't have two populations trying to use the same resource. So therefore, if you have slightly different areas for your populations, each one gets to target the primary resource. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense. Yeah.
So, and if you do, it probably won't be a huge overlap. The article from what I saw was there are very few places that will see both. The thing that's so interesting is the fact that they are actually coming out at the same time, not necessarily in the same places. So,
and it was a pretty substantial, it was a substantial part of the country, right? Like, it's going to impact lots of families. And of course, people with cats too. I'm sure my cat's going to be cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over cicada.
So my question about cat, because I don't have cats, so I am not as knowledgeable on cats, are their digestive tracts, do they tend to be more sensitive than dogs?
I mean, my experience of cats is they vomit a lot. It's one of my least favorite things about cats. And I mean, my cat's fed amazingly well, and he still has digestive unrest pretty regularly. So I don't know what that's about. My vet and I have been trying to run it down for years now, and we just haven't sorted it out. So the next step would probably be talking to a holistic or integrative vet to kind of start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. But my traditional medicine vet, who also does some Chinese medicine, hasn't found a good answer for Quinn. I do think that Quinn, if a cicada makes it in the house, because he is a house cat, I do think he would be enamored with a cicada and carry it around my house yowling while it screams. He does.
That's something to look forward to, Tina.
Well, I mean, he carries the anoles around in the fall yowling. They don't scream. They just drop their tails. So occasionally you just find a random tail somewhere. I mean, he appears to like cockroaches. He leaves me bouquets of cockroach legs. No idea why he doesn't eat the legs. I'm assuming he eats the rest of the cockroach.
So the legs are not going to have any protein, really. They're just going to be almost pure exoskeleton.
I thought they would have muscles.
They would, but I mean, it's not going to be a whole lot. I find, do you know why because this is the kind of thing that sticks in my head? You know why atolls drop their tails, don't you?
Well, it's a decoy. It's like, here, get the tail so I can get away and I'll grow a new one.
Right. And then it generally wiggles a little bit. And so it's interesting.
It does. It wiggles like a snake. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my least favorite part of the atoll is the wiggling snake tail, but it's kind of cool.
So to bring it full circle, I tried to convince you to reframe snakes as anoles with no legs, and you instead threw anoles under the bus and made them snake-like. So reverse right there that happened.
Okay. Apparently this snake trauma, I mean, we had a very, at our cottage, we have a garage that is not completely sealed off. It's got this, I don't know. Anyway, whoever built it, I wouldn't have done it that way, but they did. So the snakes can get in through the top to get down and get the mice. So I was walking out one time and I look, and there was a really long black snake. I mean, this thing was like 3-4 feet long, like, in the garage. And so for a long time, I couldn't go in the garage without going, snake, 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 I'm coming in the garage. You can leave now. It was just, in fact, Brad and I did that all the way through the Badlands. Snakey, snake, we're hiking. Snakey, snake, go away.
Yeah. I mean, we get a lot of black snakes because we have a neighbor who has chickens. So we get a lot of decent sized black snakes, and they're very, they are very interesting. I don't mind watching them. I just don't want them in the house.
Yeah, I agree.
Or by the front door when I try to go in. Yeah. I don't like being surprised by them. I don't mind if they, are just relaxed and hanging out and not surprising me.
We're there.
Yeah, Mister has a very specific snake bark that tells us he's cornered a snake. It sends chills up my spine. I'm glad when it happens outside.
Does it happen inside very often?
I have had one tiny little gardener, little Green Snake in the house once, and Christopher saved me. Okay, this is a funny story. So pull the car in, and I open the door. And as I open the door, this little teeny tiny green snake is trying to go like a cartoon character as fast as he can on the tile floor. So he's got no grip, right? So he's like squiggling as fast as he can, but he's not actually making any forward motion. And I just said, snake, and bounded out of the house. Like peace out. Like, this is obviously a Mr. Taunton problem. And so Chris goes in, and I can hear him because I have the window rolled down in the car because I'm now hiding in the car. And so
yeah,
I roll the window down.
That's the only thing that makes sense.
The window's rolled down. It's not even electric. It's actual, it's bicep powered. And I hear him, and he's doing this. Oh, come on, you little booper baby snake. She didn't mean to scare you. And he's carrying this snake out into the yard, which I greatly appreciated. But he was blaming me for scaring the snake. I made him use hand sanitizer and because salmonella, and then go in and wash his hands.
Yeah.
But I also make him rescue turtles that I don't particularly like, but we still move them in the direction they're going.
Oh, always. Always. Yeah. And then I always make turtles.
Yeah.
I love turtles.
They're cute. And I'm slowly learning that they have a lot of fertility, that there is a consciousness in there, and that they're like, they know their people and they have likes and dislikes. And I've started watching funny turtle videos and tortoise videos because they're different.
It's kind of like, I have a real fond spot for octopus. I think we talked about octopus.
I love an octopus. Yeah.
Yes.
They're great.
And I think I mentioned, on previous episodes that at the Shedd Aquarium, they had intelligence toys for their octopuses. You know, it's almost like nesting dolls, Russian nesting dolls with a treat in the very inside. So,
yeah,
they're lovely. I really.
I wonder how smart cicadas are.
Not very. They only have, I wouldn't think, anyway, they're not like, okay, if you're Edward O. Wilson, right, it's bees can do anything, and they had this collective intelligence. Most insects, however, don't actually have a brain. They just have a collection of a few neurons up there firing, which is sometimes how I love my dog, Zuzu, but sometimes I think that's all she's got is a few neurons firing up there sometimes. She's not the brightest dog I've ever owned, but she is probably the sweetest. She's kind and gentle and sweet, and I love her to death. But I sometimes wonder if how many neurons are actually firing. Anyway, insects don't have brains per se. They have collections of neurons.
So then are you just being speciesist?
Probably.
Because I do wonder, like, do they have a consciousness? It's kind of an interesting question.
I don't know. And I don't know how you would design an experiment. You can design an experiment for consciousness with creatures, like with mammals, and to a certain degree, I think, with reptiles. You actually have a brain. And you can, using a mirror, you can use some consciousness experiments. I'm not sure how you would be able to measure it in a cicada.
Interesting. Maybe somebody will write us and tell us about some new cicada research.
On cicada consciousness.
Something like that. Yes. Cicada learning.
Yeah.
Can you imagine a pet who only came out every 13 years?
Well, the food bills would be lower than what I pay, I would say. What's interesting, just in talking about consciousness, now that you've raised it,
it's a funny episode.
This is a weird episode. This is you and I. And people are going to
think, this is you and I. This is you and I every day. So
you are getting the full your family dog experience, the full Julie and the full Tina today. But I've been thinking about consciousness, actually. And I've been thinking about consciousness for a couple of reasons. One is, the more we begin to understand how animals' brains work and how they work. I mean, like, birds are people, you know, it's an insult to call somebody a bird brain, but it's really not. Birds have amazing brains and they can do some amazing things and they can remember an amazing array of, I mean, the mapping ability that birds have for hiding nuts and seeds and stuff, like the pinion jays. It's just amazing the kind of the grid system that they have in their heads. And I got to tell you, have you ever tried to build a nest, take some sticks and build a nest? This is not an easy job. And how they do this kind of thing is truly amazing. And their level and who, I don't know what, how much of that is genetically programmed, how much of it is consciousness, how much of it is learned. But I think what we're finding is that there is a whole lot more to the animal brain than we would like to, I think, sometimes admit. And I find that very interesting. And the reason I've been thinking about consciousness is because I've been working on my second novel called The Boy Who Danced for the Moon. And in it is a level of consciousness of inanimate objects. In fact, I had to write the rules of consciousness for inanimate objects. And so one of the things is there's one scene where a character is, she's a grandmother, and this is set in 1966, and she has her favorite patent leather purse. And she's very upset, and she happens to have this purse in her hand. She starts sort of really clinging to and almost twisting the handles of this patent leather purse, and the purse feels it and begins to sort of respond in kind back. And fears that she's going to actually, you know, sort of twist it to death. And so I don't think that inanimate objects in the real world have conscious feelings, but some of them in my book do. And they have rules about how they can interact with people. The purse can't talk because it doesn't have a mouth. But the stuffed animals, there are certain stuffed animals in the book, and they talk because they have mouths. But the only people that can hear them have to have their own certain level of consciousness. So there's can be consciousness on a wide variety of levels, I think. But I think that sometimes with animals, we are quick to, just as I was, quick to poo-poo the consciousness of cicadas. Who knows? Maybe they have more of a consciousness than we realize. But I don't also know how you would quite set up an experiment to prove the level of consciousness of a cicada. So that's my own little world that Julie's living in at the moment.
Well, and so I can tell you, I purchased a very inexpensive Roman coin, like an old Roman coin, and I carry it with me. And often I think of all the stories that coin could tell, right?
Like, oh, absolutely.
What kind of transactions, like, you know, the travels that coin has made and the things that it's seen and experienced. And then Franciscan brother Richard Hendricks actually recently had a really beautiful poem about kind of our own impermanence. And if you have not heard of Brother Richard, he's amazing. I learn from him every single time I get to hear him or read anything he's written, and he's pretty phenomenal. He also has a new book out. But it's, yeah. So for, I guess to bring this all back to the cicadas, I have a memory of the experience with them, and it was traumatic, right? And so now I'm looking up these dogs that I have and the cat. None of them have lived through cicadas previously. So I'm like, it's interesting. Is that how the Roman coin feels sometimes in my pocket? Right? No, I've experienced this before. I have information and can't get it out.
I love that. And I have things like that in my life too, that have been passed down through my family. And I'm like, if only this spoon, who has the initials of Gertrude Elting Wynkoop and dates back to like 1805. Boy, I really wish the spoon could tell me what everything it's dished up over the years, you know, and where has it traveled to and stuff. But your Roman coin would be far more experienced than my spoon. I will admit that.
It's interesting stuff. It's an interesting take on things.
I think. It is. Yes. And so people ask me, you know, like I've got friends who are scientists or who are lawyers or whatever. And they're like, I could never write a novel like this. I could never. How do you do it? How do you come up with a story? And I thought to myself, because I kind of live this. I mean, this is how I see the world. So I think that if you live in a very grounded, practical way, it's much harder to tap into that abstract end of things, that alternative way of looking at things. But on the other hand, I've had some friends who are scientists, very creative people, very creative and open-minded in looking at the physical or biological world around them. And I could totally see them writing a novel because they refuse to sort of be boxed in. They're more creative in their approach to how they view the world and how they view science. So I think a lot of it just has to do with what's your orientation to life and what are you, where are you willing to suspend your disbelief?
I don't know. The older I get, the more I try to just have a willing spirit to learn new things and to view things from a different perspective. And I can listen to someone's perspective. And maybe in the end, I still say, okay, well, I don't believe it the way that person sees it and believes it, but I don't have to agree. But I am really trying to suspend my disbelief more often and be more willing to learn and experience new things, or at least a new perspective. Maybe not, it's not a new thing, but it is just a new perspective.
I think that's great. And I think that that's something that is desperately needed in our very polarized environment that we now live in. I think that ability to take a step back and say, I don't necessarily agree with you, but I'd like to hear what you have to say, is unfortunately a rarity. And I don't think we see that as much as we used to. And I think there's various reasons for that. So I say bravo for Tina to be taking that attitude of, I want to learn something new. I want to see something, you know, and I want to understand why you see this in a way that I don't. And I think we need a lot more of that.
Well, I mean, imagine if I hadn't read the USA Today article, then I would have been like walking through May and all of a sudden got hit in the head by a cicada and gone, oh no, and not been able to mentally prepare and to really pull apart my trauma from the last time I experienced it and be ready, knowing that it will be over toward the end of June. And that I survived it before and I will survive it again. And yes, it's inconvenient and gross and loud and all of that thing, but it's also something to experience and maybe roll around in that. It is in this case, it's something that only happens every, you know, 200 plus years. And then Right. Maybe I need to appreciate that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like we have an eclipse, a full eclipse coming across Ohio, April 8th. And the next one won't be for, that comes across in this area for a very long time. I will be long dead. So, you know, we're making preparations to go and see the full eclipse. And so I think I also just want to mention to you, this is a little ray of hope in your cicada drama, that hope for dry weather. Because if you have dry weather, the cicadas will mate sooner and die more quickly. So they will be gone sooner. In wet or moist weather, they tend to hang out a little bit longer. So instead of being 4 weeks, it would probably be more like 6 weeks. So hope for some dry weather. And then well, the cicada invasion will be shorter.
And again, like there is a part of me that's just going to try to navigate it from a perspective of, this too shall pass and it'll be all right. And, you know, hope that I don't have big vet bills because dogs decide to eat them ravenously.
Right.
And but hopefully like I said, none of my dogs will decide that their tiny little demonic beasts outside and that they cannot go outside.
That would probably be worse than having them eat them, would be your dog's refusing to go outside. But
yeah.
Anyway, so the bottom line here is the cicadas are coming. We will post a link to the articles that Tina has sent to me, including a map of the states and where different broods are probably going to be hatching. So you can take a look at that. And there's really nothing to be seriously concerned about. Just keep an eye on your dog and your cat. And if they seem to be showing signs of not feeling well, get them to the vet to make sure that they're not having some sort of ill reaction to eating one too many crunchy cicadas. They're kind of like popcorn for some dogs. So with that and this very obtuse sideways kind of motion through this, we hope that you have enjoyed sort of the tour of Julie and Tina's minds, which could be
terrifying.
That could be a traumatic experience for some people too.
So. It sometimes is a little crowded in here.
It does. It gets really crowded in my head. You know, and when I'm writing a novel, all those characters are in my head too. And they're like, sometimes they're very insistent. You need to write my story. And Julie, you need to get out of the way and let me write it. Stop trying to tell me what I'm going to do. So that's kind of an interesting experience.
So, and I'll also send you, I will send you a link to the Brother Richard poem that I'm talking about, this is totally like, this is our jive, but it's the fidelity of things. So
yes.
If you don't know, Brother Richard Hendricks, look him up. He's amazing. And I'm so grateful that, I get to know a little bit about him and call him very, very loosely an acquaintance, a friend, cause he's fantastic. And I'll send that to Julie right now, and we'll be sure to give him, of course, all of this poem's amazing. So it's okay. Not stuffy. So for the people who are a little worried about poetry, don't be. This is some good stuff.
Good. Good. And it just came through. So thank you, Tina.
You're welcome.
All right, then. We'll see you all next time on Your Family Dog.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.